let's say you've got a heart for a orphanage in Uganda and you want to give to them, but there is IRS regulations, there's banking issues, there's regulations in the for the charity in the receiving country. And people look at all of those hurdles and all of that expense, and they wind up just saying, can't do it. And so the gift doesn't get made. And so, you know, our belief is that if we can change that, if we can make global giving easy, then more gifts will flow to the areas of the world that need it the most. And ultimately, charities everywhere will have all they need to accomplish their mission.
Welcome to the Journey to Impact podcast, a podcast for people with significant resources that want to have significant impact. Your host is the founder and principal of the Gillentine Group, a financial planning and investment management firm that seeks to engage the hearts of people who want to use their wealth to create meaningful impact. He's the author of the book Journey to Impact, and he's had over 20 years of experience in the impact space working across the U.S., Africa, Australia, and Europe. Here's your host, Ed Gillentine.
Welcome to the Journey to Impact podcast. I'm your host, Ed Gillentine, and I'm joined today by my good friend, Bob Collins, the CEO of TrustBridge. Bob, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Ed, and it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, I'm pumped to have you join us on the podcast. You know, I've heard bits and pieces of your story over the years, but never sort of put it all together. And I'm particularly excited to hear about where TrustBridge is, you know, over the years as the concept was sort of growing and becoming reality to where it is today is pretty exciting to me. So, but before we get in too deep, let me just give our listeners a little bit of background. Bob from Tampa Bay, or not necessarily from there, but that's where he resides now. He's a graduate of the University of South Florida, got his MBA from the University of Tampa, got into the investing world at a very young age out of college, Raymond James, and then moved over into that portfolio analyst manager world. Most recently, managing director and co-chief investment officer, Goldman Sachs Asset Management. He's had a lot of experience with private equity and impact business. And then age 38, made the jump from the for-profit world to the charity world, which is interesting. And I'm looking forward to hearing about that. 16 years with the National Christian Foundation. And then he is now, as I mentioned, the CEO of TrustBridge. He's married to Tricia, 5 kids, 2 grandkids. Are grandkids easier than kids? That's what I hear.
I love grandkids. Best thing in life.
Get to send them back, right? Yeah. So, Bob, let's start with TrustBridge. Why don't you help our listeners understand what it is and why it's important?
Yeah, so basically TrustBridge was established several years ago because we saw the need to make cross-border giving or global giving easier. What we saw time and again at the National Christian Foundation is that people want to give to a charity overseas. Let's say you've got a heart for an orphanage in Uganda and you want to give to them, but there is IRS regulations, there's banking issues, there's regulations in the for the charity in the receiving country. And people look at all of those hurdles and all of that expense and they wind up just saying, can't do it. And so the gift doesn't get made. And so, you know, our belief is that if we can change that, if we can make global giving easy, then more gifts will flow to the areas of the world that need it the most. And ultimately, charities everywhere will have all they need to accomplish their mission. So that's why we got it started. And yeah, it's been working. We're on pace this year to facilitate about $100 million in giving.
Wow.
To various charities all around the world. Basically, by doing just this, by making global giving easy, and it's really opening up those gates and that money is flowing.
That's amazing. When did TrustBridge officially sort of open up their doors?
Yeah, it was in 2017, you know, a little bit over 6 years ago.
That's amazing. And if you think about sort of the assets that have flowed through there, I mean, the impact's got to be pretty crazy. And I want to chase down. My technical brain wants to chase down, man, that's probably a lot of taxes that have been saved, especially when you get into to overseas. I don't even know the impact there. But I do remember sitting in my office with you. I think it was you and Chalk Penn and Greg Sperry. Jason Fisher, I think, was there, and just sort of brainstorming about how that could happen. And you guys were fairly far along, but this had to be what? It was after the Great Recession, the financial meltdown, so 2012, 2013, and then just all of the work that it takes to set something up, because y'all have offices where around the world?
One of the ways in which we are making global giving easy is by creating a global network of like-minded foundations. So I would say technically we don't have offices around the world, but we have partners.
Right.
Other Christian donor advised fund foundations like Stewardship in the UK, Tree of Life in South Africa. And so we are all cooperating to mobilize that giving.
I've often thought of it almost like a money swap, right? And, you know, we do a lot of work in Ethiopia. And so, you know, in the currency world, right? Funds don't technically or realistically cross borders. You know, you may have $1 billion in Germany and they need to do 500 million in Ethiopia and another 500 million somewhere else. And so Ethiopia needs some money in Germany. And so it's almost like a debit and credit thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you get in a country like Ethiopia that's starved for cash, they're not going to let their USD out very easily. What you can do is find somebody like you guys. Y'all are the only ones I know that do it like this. See, okay, we've got some people in the U.S. that want to give to Ethiopia. So you kind of swap it around. Is that a reasonable, dumbed down version conceptually?
Yeah, no, you're right on target. One of the things that we did with TrustBridge is in our accounting systems from the very beginning, we virtualized the money flow. What that means is that through journal entries, as you were saying, we can track the movement of value separate from the actual wires going here and there. In your example, and maybe we'll say it's Romania and not Ethiopia, because we don't have a partner there. But in Romania, let's just say hypothetically, we've got a Romanian who wants to give 10,000 euro out of the country. We just say, put it in our Romanian network member, and you can get your local tax deduction. And then separately, we'll fund, you know, whatever charitable gift you're trying to make somewhere else. And then that money resides in an account at that Romanian foundation. And then the next time we want to make a grant into Romania, we've already got the money there and we just send it in.
Yeah.
So what happens is that our balances in various geographic locations around the world are going up and going down, you know, periodically. Right. Then we just have to rebalance the system. If we've got some money accumulating somewhere and we've got a deficit somewhere else, then we just do that rebalance. So I would say probably on average, we only do one real transaction for roughly every 10 kind of virtual transactions.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense to me. And I, as a money nerd, I think that's fascinating. But I want to get sort of more to your story. At the same time, letting the listeners know my dumbed down version and your gracious sort of even more clearly making it simple behind the scenes. There's an awful lot of whether it's hamster wheels turning or, ducks paddling under the surface, because you've got currency fluctuations. You've got, it makes my head hurt thinking about the different regulations across countries and stuff like that. So well done. And I know it's incredibly complex and you guys are killing it. All right, let's back up and hear a little bit about how you got to where you were. I buzzed through your bio and it's crazy interesting, but sort of give us the Bob Collins Cliff Note version of how you got to where you are now.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. I look at my work life in three chapters, basically. So chapter one is in the for-profit business world. I started off in investment banking and investment management with a regional firm here, Raymond James. Well, it was regional back then.
Regional back then, wasn't it? Yeah. Now they got a football team.
Yeah. And so I did that for 17 years. Towards the end of that chapter of my career, I actually was working for Goldman Sachs, started there, and then was ultimately promoted to managing director and co-chief investment officer for their asset management business in London. So that was, so I was doing well in that part of my career and doing well on a very big stage in London. But I really felt the calling to do something that was more family friendly, but also something that would help me stay centered in my faith. And so at the age of 38, retired and moved the family back to Tampa Bay. Then I started with the National Christian Foundation. First, my role here was opening the Tampa Bay office for the National Christian Foundation, which I did that for many years. And towards the end of that time, and I was with NCF about 16 years, towards the end of that time, I was at the executive leadership in Atlanta, Georgia. In those last few years, that's when TrustBridge got started. And so there was a committee that was working on, hey, what does it look like for NCF to go global? And the answer was actually NCF really probably isn't the best vehicle to go global. We should create a separate organization, which would be headquartered in Switzerland because the banking and regulatory infrastructure there was very friendly. And it should not have Christian in the name, which we can talk about. So we ultimately, you know, created that entity. Then I was recruited to be CEO of that entity. And I wore both hats for a short period of time, but as TrustBridge grew, I had to make a choice at some point. And chose to, you know, to migrate from NCF to just full-time CEO of TrustBridge.
I have found that a person's childhood significantly influenced, a lot of times parents or grandparents, sort of their journey, maybe not always in a good way. but have you found, like, relative to your faith, your philanthropic and impact business work, like, was that seed planted as a child, do you think? Like, how has that been a part of it?
Yeah, so my family has some faith heritage, particularly with my grandparents on my, actually on both sides. I didn't know my grandfather on my mother's side, but he was a pastor. I actually was not a Christian until relatively late in life. I was saved when I was 29 years old, you know, roughly. 9 years before I retired. So retired from the business world. There was good character and work ethic and that sort of thing modeled for me, but the faith part of it wasn't strong. Yeah.
Were your folks involved in the financial world? What made you, you know, go to school, get the business degree, get the MBA, you know, all that stuff? Intentional, or did you sort of fall into it?
Yeah, it was intentional, but maybe not for the right reasons.
Yeah, that's my story.
So, my father and mother were both in the medical field. I didn't have anybody in my family that had anything to do with Wall Street. But as I was getting into my senior year in college and knowing that, okay, I need to go out and find a job, my thinking was very simple, which is, if I could get involved in a business where there was a lot of money flowing around, if I could just make a very small percentage of that, I could be very wealthy. Yeah. It was very simple thinking. So I was trying to figure out, how can I get into a business where there's billions of dollars, flowing around, and I could just take a very, very small percentage of that. And of course, you know, that's how Wall Street works. In fact, you know, as I mentioned, towards the end of my career, our team in London was managing $36 billion in various investment mandates. So our fees were very, very low, but even with those low fees, that was a lot of money.
Yeah, for real. I think I see behind your, over your shoulder, your CFA certificate. I never worked up the courage to get that, But I did get a chartered advisor in philanthropy, which is one of the more interesting designations. And Phil Cabeda was the guy that sort of founded that. And we had him on a podcast last week. It was interesting when you talk about careers, he wanted to be a teacher sort of a sneak preview. So you can go ahead and start thinking about this. One of the rapid fire questions we close with is what's a favorite book or a book that you'd recommend? And his was Robert Frost. I think he actually grew up down the street from Frost. I mean, like met the guy, but he's like Ivy League, Oxford. Like he was made to be a linguistics, you know, Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, literature professor. But evidently back in, I guess, sounds like the late 70s, early 80s, he couldn't find a job. So he got into life insurance teaching. Who'd have thought that, right? Anyway, he became one of the most knowledgeable on strategic philanthropic giving relative to tax codes, all that stuff. But, you know, we were talking before we jumped online. He understood early on it was about story. It was about connecting with people's hearts. Mm-hmm. He looked up and I don't know, 40, 50 years later, he retired and started that program, which had a huge impact. So I think about, you know, how God moves us along our paths. I'm also not convinced. I do feel like making money has a little bit of a negative connotation in the U.S. And I've always thought, I'm not subscribing to, was it Gordon Gekko that said greed is good in that Wall Street movie? I'm not subscribing to that, but I do think, making money is good. I digress. What I did want to ask you about, you've been doing this for a while, right? And you've worked with some pretty wealthy people, which is a different skill set, a different problem, set of problems that they deal with. What are some of the things that you've seen, whether it was, you know, your days in London, your years in London or back in the U.S., in the philanthropic world that have changed for the better over the last however many years? Maybe it's a DAF, you know, maybe it's people's paradigm. Anyway, talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, there's been some big changes in the last 20 years in the charitable landscape. I would say, you know, going back many years now, and I think as a lot of people know already, the Donor Advised Fund has been a huge movement or phenomenon within the charitable industry. And now you're to the point where there's roughly $200 billion in donor advised funds, probably flowing about $70 billion a year. So it's become a huge factor in philanthropy. And I think it's a good thing. I know a lot of people are trying to criticize donor advised funds, but, you know, it has enabled, I think, a lot more giving to happen than would have ordinarily happened because people can more easily implement strategies such as giving stock or giving business interests and real estate and that sort of thing. And it also, what I've observed is that when people have a balance in their donor advised fund, they tend to be more generous because the money's already in the hands of charity. It's a lot easier to let go of it once you've already let go of it. You know, so
yeah.
So what I've seen, and I've worked with many, many families over the years, is once they start using a donor advised fund, they're giving rises because they have a balance. As I say, they're giving it away, and then they actually get excited about, okay, how can I get more into my donor advised fund so I can keep going? So I think it's been a significantly positive impact on philanthropy. Then, you know, the second kind of big wave, if you will, in philanthropy in the U.S., but not just the U.S., around the world, is this idea of impact investing or mission-related investing or faith-driven investing, however you want to look at it. And we're on that wave right now. For a lot of folks, this isn't new, but it is something that has grown from kind of just, there's a few kind of leading edge proponents to it's getting very much mainstream now. In fact, one thing that was interesting is the Chronicle of Philanthropy puts out a report every year called the Giving USA Report. And one thing that really struck me, two things actually that really struck me in that report, one is there was a very large downtick in charitable giving. by kind of the middle America givers. It's actually a little bit alarming how rapidly attitudes and behaviors are shifting related to charitable giving. But on the flip side, one thing that was very interesting is that the younger generations, the millennials and Gen Z, they are looking at, I guess that they would call social ventures or how they spend their money as a way to correct the ills of society. And that is actually, it's gotten to the point where those generations feel like that is actually more effective than giving to charity, which is the first time in history, I believe, that that has happened, where people say, hey, you know, the way I shop, the way I spend, you know, the businesses that I support with my spending is actually more impactful than giving to charity. So I think we're still riding that wave, and we're going to see significantly more in the coming decades towards, again, you know, mission-related businesses and mission-related investing.
I think that's fascinating. There's a million ways we can go, right? But think about that mission-related investing, and we'll pick on the concept of like a Tom Shoes, who was kind of one of the earlier sort of improvisers in that world. And go back to what you said about getting in a pool with a lot of money flowing through it and taking a little bit. You can almost reverse that, right? If I can pay $5 more for a $50 pair of shoes, and frankly, I don't remember Tom's being like super high quality at our house anyway. Felt like the kids and my wife were buying a new pair every, you know, 3-4 months because they were worn out. But the idea of helping people and providing a pair of shoes or whatever their original strategy was, I'm open to paying $10 more for a $50 pair of shoes. And you get enough people doing that, you could really have some impact without, you know, having a major impact on your budget, which is a huge swing from, I feel like, from the 80s, I guess, cheaper, 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 right? And so that can really move the needle. And of course, like anything, any idea, you get into it and you realize, oh dear, that was a great idea to help children in poverty in, you know, Rwanda get shoes. But at the same time, we might have unintentionally put the shoe industry out of business in Rwanda. So, yeah, right. You know, you live and learn. But I really feel like I think that's here to stay, particularly with these two generations. I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah, I think it is. And that's why it's interesting that there's some generational differences there, which means as our generation gets older and goes out to pasture and these younger generations take over, it is going to become, I think, more and more prevalent. And you're seeing it, especially in the online commerce world. It seems like the majority of new businesses, new brands, new products and services all have some sort of social good component to them. And so, hey, you know, buy this and we're helping out with this cause or this group of people.
So you've been in the equity world for a long time. At the end of the day, when you analyze equities or any investment, it really kind of gets back to future cash flows, right? And so when you think about carving off a little bit, generationally speaking too, right? Maximizing profit, you know, Milton Friedman, all those guys, a bit of a shift. And I probably should clarify my earlier comments, like making money is good. I'm not saying making money just to pile it up and hoard it. But if you have something that makes money, in my view, businesses for the flourishing of the community, of society at large, that means you have some wiggle room to help. One way to help is, you know, give to the local theater or the local food pantry. I've found maybe a better way to help is have better wages for your employees. Again, you know, raising your salaries, you know, 5-10% has an outsized impact on the laborer, the employee, relative to the profits of the company. But when you're on the asset management side, the analyst side, you're like, man, we could go in and, you know, cut costs because you're paying them more. like that paradigm shift, Bob, I would be interested to hear how it worked in your brain, right? Going from a focus on profit to where you are now, but also what you're seeing with the previous generation relative to the current younger generation. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah. You know, there's a few different thoughts that are sparked with that. I think one is that, you know, I attribute this to Henry Kastner. I'm not totally sure he coined the phrase, but, you know, he says that all capital has an agenda, right? And so I think it all starts with the ownership and the capital that's been provided to fund the business. If it's a purely profit-oriented capital, it doesn't mean that you're not going to do social good in the business. But what it means is that you need to connect it to better outcomes. So, you know, if I'm going to give away, you know, one pair of shoes for every pair of shoes that I sell, I need to demonstrate that it's actually increasing brand equity, it's increasing sales, it's increasing profitability and return on invested capital, because that's really what I care about. But if we have, let's say, in our context, you know, Christian capital behind a business, then that is going to drive an agenda that is more tilted towards, let's say, altruistically helping people as opposed to just maximizing the return on investment. One of the things that is part of my story is, you know, in a brief period while I was still working at NCF, but before I started up with TrustBridge, actually launched a small private equity firm. And my plan at that point was to go down this path of being a faith-driven private equity firm. And we bought three businesses. And then I was recruited to join and run TrustBridge. And so, you know, I gradually unwound all those. But just as an example, one of the businesses was a home healthcare business here in Tampa Bay. Typically, a very well-run home healthcare business peaks out at about a 15% EBITDA margin. And our plan was, and for a brief period of time, what we said is when we get up to an 11% EBITDA margin, then we would basically cap it out. And whatever we were able to do above that, we would plow back into our patients and our employees. So there was basically a financial finish line for the shareholders, which is 11% EBITDA margin, and you could work through and they're still making very good money. So that's not a huge compromise, but you know, the extra money was going to go into our employees and our patients, as I said. And so I really liked that model, but that was only possible because our capital, you know, shared our values.
Yeah. The agenda of your capital. And that's mm-hmm. what we found in Ethiopia too. Like when you got the right investment group, it's powerful. If you mix it, not that people that don't want to do that are bad or evil, right? It's just the agenda. And if you get mixed agendas, it's challenging. I would love to have a follow-up conversation too, as social entrepreneurship and impact investing and business missions has become more mainstream. What are some of the negatives, right? You know, you hear people talking about greenwashing or like with live golf sport washing, whatever that is. And I'm not trying to minimize it, but, you know, there's an awful lot of washing going on to make stuff sound like what we want to hear. Right. So but that's a conversation for another time. I recently read Fortune's Children, maybe. I want to say it was written 10, 15 years ago, maybe longer, about the Vanderbilt family. Hmm. By far, like, I don't even think we have anything to compare to it today, over the globe, the wealthiest family in the world. And within 50 years, 3.5 generations, nobody was a millionaire, which is, I mean, it's really remarkable. I highly recommend people to get the book. It's pretty easy read. You get the concept pretty early on. But what I wanted to ask you about that it reminded me of was maybe Larry Burkett said this. I don't know. Every investing or financial decision is an emotional decision. It's rarely, I've never seen it math, right? We all, as analysts, we like to think it's all about math and spreadsheets, but I've rarely seen that. When you're working with wealthy people and you get into the heart issues, right? With families, typically, I suspect is what you're working with versus an individual that's just like, we're going to do what I want to do. What are some of the challenges that you run into, and what are some of the things early on in a conversation with a family that's trying to be generous that you have to work through to make sure that they can be as effective as possible?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different answers. You know, different families are in different places. I would say that, you know, some of the families that we work with are extremely generous, and we're just trying to show them how they can give more and give more tax effectively. Sometimes it's the other way around, but actually, I'm very encouraged by those cases. And what I mean is, you know, the Bible says, where your money goes, there your heart goes also. And of course, a lot of sermons have been taught about, you know, the sequence of it's first your money, then your heart. So a lot of the families that we work with, particularly business owners over the years, their main motivation initially with the giving and the advanced plan giving that we've done through the National Christian Foundation and TrustBridge is about saving taxes, right?
Sure. Yeah.
But you wind up releasing, let's say, $1 million or $10 million gift. But the primary motivation was, hey, you know, this is such a great tax deal. How can I not do this? Right.
Yep.
Then what happens is, well, now they got all this money in the hands of charity, and then they start giving it away, and they start seeing the impact of it, and they start getting involved with the charities that they're giving to, and their heart is just moving in that direction. And then you come back and say, well, I want to keep doing this. This is great. I love what's going on. That's an interesting phenomenon. But I guess to more directly answer your question, I would say one of the biggest things that I've seen that, and I try to help families with, is moving from reactive giving to proactive giving. And what I mean by that is that a lot of families, almost by default, they adopt this posture of people are soliciting donations from them, and they're evaluating them and basically just saying yes or no. So somebody says, oh, can you give $10,000 to this church building fund? They're like, okay, sure, I'll give to that. And then somebody else says, can you give $20,000 to this children's charity? And they say, no, I'm not going to give that. But what we try to get people to do is to say, well, let's back out of all of that. And let's start with just silence and prayer and hearing what God has called you to. You know, what are your passions? What do you really care about? What really makes you angry when you look at the world and say, this needs to change? And then start to proactively decide where and how you want to address that problem that you've been called to work in, you know, by God, and then reach out to charities that are doing a good job. Instead of waiting for them to come to you, you're going to them. And that also gives you a lens that makes it easier to say no to the 3,000 other requests that you get every year to give money to this and that.
I think that's fascinating. And that's what we try to do with our clients. I was thinking recently, this has been a year or two ago, we met with the two generations, you know, at their lake house. And we started with, you know, what is money? What's it for? And what are you on planet Earth to do? Faith-based or not, right? What are you on planet Earth to do? It is interesting. We do our giving very haphazardly, but you'd never approach a portfolio with, oh, well, these guys called me up and said they got a great deal. No, you construct the portfolio with where you want to go. And that's rare to do with giving. And saying no is tough. When you're talking to your clients, I'm just curious, how hard did they struggle with no?
Yeah, it is. There's another turn of a phrase that we've developed over the years, which, you know, a lot of people have started private foundations. And of course, private foundations is a huge misnomer, because there's nothing private about a private foundation. It's out in the public. Everybody can see everything that's going on in it.
And you don't get as good a tax deduction.
Yeah. And what happens is, once you start a private foundation, then people are coming out of the woodwork all the time asking you for money, because it's all out there in the public. And so you started the private foundation because you wanted to have fun giving money away, basically. And you end up being in the business of just saying no 90 whatever percent of the time.
Right.
You know, it's a real drag. And so we do help, or try to help people think through these things, like I say, to have clarity on your calling and your passion. Makes it easier to say no, because you it's a lot like investing still, right? Is, hey, you know, if I've got a particular philosophy and focus in my investing, then it makes it very easy to say no. You know, if I am and focused on just investing in SaaS related computer software businesses, then if somebody comes to me with a food business or, you know, a manufacturing business, I just say, no, that's not what I'm trying to do. And so I think it's the same way with giving.
It's like a bond guy coming to you when you're trading equities. Sorry, you got the wrong number. I do think I love what you said about it helps you say no easier. In a sense, I guess emotionally, it's probably not any easier, but you do know I'm a steward of these resources. You know, for Liz and I, we kind of came up with a portfolio concept of, you know, international, domestic, kids at risk, justice, and the arts. Like that's kind of that's where we go. But it was helpful when people would come, we at least in our own minds could say, you know what, this is what our focus is. And so we kind of have to say no, because we're stewards. And if you were an equity guy at Goldman Sachs and you go buy a bunch of bonds, right, you're going to get fired because you're not being a steward. And the same thing for us. Some of the responses were a little less than encouraging. But at the end of the day, that's our job. And so I found that to be super helpful, talking with people, to take the onus off of them that you got to be doing and helping. I heard somebody tell me years ago, water can be powerful or it can be a stagnant swamp. The difference in a river and like these big dams, when they focus the water, that's just a huge difference versus mosquitoes and all the other stuff that comes. I know we got to land the plane, Bob, and there's a bunch of different things I wanted to talk about. I'm going to try to sneak one more thing in. When you think about private foundations that you mentioned versus a donor advised fund, you know, back in the day, the private foundation was really the only way to go. But they're pretty pricey. They're not very private. And yeah, so when you're talking to people, how often are you saying, you know what, for what you want to do, that private foundation is probably smart for you now versus, you know, 30, 40 years ago, for these larger donors that are wanting to gift, you know, 25, 30, 40, 50 million plus, how has the donor advised sort of affected that in your mind, donor advised fund?
Great question. Because yeah, I think the views and the utilization of donor advised funds has definitely changed over the years. There was, you know, going back 20 years or so, this strongly held view that, you know, donor advised fund was for relatively small giving, you know, like tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even maybe a couple of $1 million a year. But then once you got beyond that, you really should go to a private foundation. And that has changed a lot in the years. In fact, with the National Christian Foundation, I don't think I'm violating any confidence to say we do have one donor advised fund or one family relationship that is close to $1 billion in a donor advised fund. You know, it can be used for anything, and multiple families that have multi-hundred-million-dollar in donor advised fund. So it's not just, oh, private foundations for big and donor advised funds for small. What I see and what I talk to families about is that there's four major giving vehicles. If you really have a lot of money that you want to steward charitably and you have a lot of maybe complexity in your affairs, there are four vehicles that can be brought to bear. One is the private foundation, one is donor advised fund, one is supporting organization, and then there are charitable trusts, like charitable remainder trusts. And I've seen families have all four vehicles because they all four fit a separate need. Quickly, I would say, you know, the private foundation is most useful for when you want to employ family members, because it has the greatest flexibility to be able to pay relatives to do work in philanthropy. The donor advised fund is best for privacy and anonymity, because there's no public disclosure around any whatever activity you've got going on in your donor advised fund. And it's the most convenient of all of them. The supporting organization, you typically do have to have more scale to do that. Supporting organization is basically a charity, but it exists as essentially a subsidiary of a larger charity. And so it's best for reinvestment flexibility because it doesn't have the tight self-dealing and conflict of interest rules that a private foundation or a donor advised fund would have. And so like if you wanted to have 10 or 20 million and allocate a lot of that to impact investments, but you also want to co-invest with your charitable money alongside your family office money, the supporting organization does great at that. And then, of course, the charitable remainder trust or charitable trusts in general have significant tax advantages, and particularly around business and property transactions. So if you have a huge capital gain event, you should be looking hard at charitable trusts.
You know, it's interesting, too. The misnomer is that donor advised funds they just trap money. It never gets given, and that private foundations are required to give their 4 or 5%. My experience, and you're in the middle of it, so you can confirm or deny this, is that even though there is more flexibility on the timing of the donor advised fund, it seems to me that they're more like a conduit. Like you mentioned, out of, you know, $200 billion, y'all have done $70 billion, you know, flowing through. It feels like as a percentage, a lot more money goes through the conduit of DAFs to the charity than a private foundation.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, those statistics that I cited were kind of industry-wide statistics. Sure. But if you look at the National Christian Foundation in isolation, if you looked at a 10 or 20 year average payout of the donor advised funds, it's been like 30 to 40% per year is going out every year. Yeah. So much, much higher than the 5% minimum.
That seems to match up with when I was on the board of one of the local ones here. All right, we got to land the plane. Rapid fire. This is how you know that you're interesting, because I always ask interesting people these three questions. One book, one quote, and one person. So we'll start with a book. If you could recommend one book to everyone to read, and it doesn't have to have anything to do with what we talked about. You could be reading, you know, historical fiction or whatever. What's one book that either you're reading right now or that sort of changed your life?
Yeah, there've been a number of them, but, you know, harking back to earlier in this conversation, there was a book called When Helping Hurts by Brian Ficker that really changed my life. And I recommend it to everybody who's trying to give away money, because it is, once you read that book, you're like, wow, you know, have I really been helping people with my giving? I need to think harder about this. So that was very impactful.
It had the same impact on me. And I try to reread it every 2 or 3 years, you know, just as a reminder. Okay, if you could leave everybody with one quote, what would that be?
Yeah, so I'm not a big quote guy, but I would say for me, it would be, it is more blessed to give than to receive.
All right, Matthew 5 or 6, I feel like. And then it's always good to quote Jesus, right? Really king, or maybe that was Paul. I think Jesus started, Paul quoted him.
That was actually, yeah, that was Jesus. Yeah.
One person you would say in 60 seconds or less that really influenced your life.
Yeah, there've been a whole lot, but I'll give props to Greg Sperry. Greg Sperry is a senior gift planning attorney at NCF. He has taught me an enormous amount, but also is just a fantastic guy, really spiritually mature, and a great role model.
Yeah, I would agree. He's a fantastic guy. A lot of stuff going on in that brain of his, isn't it?
Yeah, he is a genius. Yeah.
Plus he likes to play golf. So mm-hmm. I'm all in.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic. Yeah. I appreciate you joining us, Bob. There's been a million different ways we could go. So we may have to circle back and just maybe we can create like the Bob Collins show or something. Maybe we should get Greg involved and then throw in like Amy Minich to spice it up. And
that would be fun. Party. I love that.
All right, brother. Really good talking to you. And I'm looking forward to the next time.
Excellent. Thanks, Ed. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. We love your feedback. So please let us know what you thought about this episode, as well as what you'd like to hear more of in the future. For more information, impact resources, or to purchase a copy of the book, Journey to Impact, visit edgillentine.com. That's E-D-G-I-L-L-E-N-T-I-N-E. GILLENTINE.com. The book is also available through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Target.com. For Ed Gillentine speaking inquiries or advertising opportunities, send us an email at ajourneytoimpact@gmail.com. This has been a presentation of the Journey to Impact podcast team. Executive producer Ed Gillentine, produced and edited by Joey Woodruff. Special thanks to Stephen Chandler.